Okay, so today we're going to look at Mitzvot 124 through 129. So the first one. Right. So Mitzvah 124.
Go back to talking about why women can't. Okay.
No, move along.
Right. Not to separate the head of a bird brought as a chatat. So not to separate the head. So in general, the way that we do shechita, the way that we do ritual slaughter, is you cut from the front, cut with a knife from the front, but you're also not supposed to sever the head. I think you're not even supposed to totally sever the trachea. You're supposed to just cut right to the very back of it. That's the trick, is to cut exactly right, cut enough to open it up, to kill it instantly, to not cause it pain, to have the blood drain properly, but not to completely sever. So there's a trick with that. And, you know, I guess you just learn the feel through practice. And, of course, the knife has to be totally sharp with no nicks, since you check it each time. This is a different kind of, different method of killing. So I don't want to say it's a different method of shechita.
This is not a ritual slaughter in the sense for eating.
Right, so that's my understanding, is that this is not an eaten offering, because some offerings are eaten.
Right.
So I'm pretty sure that this one is not eaten.
Well, birds are sort of hard to eat in general anyway, unless they're...
So
what
this...
do you do with it?
When they just burn it.
Burn it. So this is... So there's various different offerings. One group of offerings is called a chatat, a sin offering. And a poor person, and this the chatat is of varying amounts, depending on how much money you have. You could bring a whole sheep, you could bring down to a bird, right, depending on how much money you have.
So this is the bird one.
So this is the bird one. So therefore, it's the offering of a poor person, right? So the coin should not sunder from a fowl brought as an offering, which is called a chatat of fowl, the head from the body, when he cuts it with the fingernail. For it is stated, umalak, and he shall sever its head from against its nape, but shall not divide it asunder. So that's what the pasuk says.
I wonder why.
So the sense of the verb malak is that the kohen digs his fingernail in at the nape, at what is called the neck bone. He cuts the bone with his fingernail until he reaches the windpipe and the gullet. Right, he cuts the organs also with his fingernail, or at least the greater part of one of them. This is the ritual sling of the chatat of fowl. And the kohen must concentrate that he should not cut everything completely until the head will be separated from the body. For this reason, it is stated, he shall not divide it asunder.
Well, did they have... I guess they had knives, obviously.
Yeah, so the question is, what's going on with this? Obviously, they're killing everything else with a knife. So it's interesting. First of all, he says, we don't understand this. Just like I said in other korbanot, there's only so much the human being can understand, and this is not inside of it. This is just...
The fingernail part.
The whole thing. Yeah, he said that we don't have the ability, nor would someone... This is interesting how he writes this. Nor would someone whose little finger is thicker than our hips, meaning somebody that much bigger than us, also wouldn't have the understanding to find a contendable reason, even by way of plain meaning, about the details of the offering. So that's about the details of all the offerings. For us, it is enough for this task of ours to convey about the subject of the offerings in a general way some bit of reason in accord with the ordinary meaning, as I have already written above what I have known and heard. So for the subject of Malika and the admonition not to separate it completely, this too is among the details of the offering. So we don't really know. That's what he's saying. And even if we would know a lot, we wouldn't know. That being said, let's try to figure out what makes sense. So it's interesting that he now brings it right down to a very earthy level. What makes sense is, this is the offering of a poor person. And a poor person really needs to work every minute just to put bread on the table. Mm-hmm. They don't have a lot of time for an offering. They don't have a lot of, you know, they have to come in and go out. They did something wrong, they need to take care of it, and they need to get back to work. So you shouldn't make them wait. Shouldn't make them wait to go get the knife, to check the knife, to even flip the bird over to get the right spot. This way the bird is already the way you're holding it, with the back of the neck up. So you don't have to flip the bird, you don't have to get the knife, you don't have to check the knife. You've saved three activities already. It's interesting to think about how much time that really takes. You know, you're in an offering zone. You have a knife right there. You might even have a stack of checked ones. I don't know, or you... maybe you have to check each one, but you could theoretically have somebody who checks knives. Right. You could have a production line, right? How much time are you saving? In a way, it's sort of like our days, you know, where we feel like we're waiting so long for a page to load. Like, no, how much time can I waste here?
It's instantaneous gratification.
You know what is also interesting? So they're holding it against their body, but the head is down, and they're working from the nape, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the animal doesn't see it.
That's true,
also very benign, you know?
Uh-huh, that's true.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. And they wouldn't be turned where they would be uncomfortable.
Yeah, like they would be facing, and the guy would, you know, so look in the eyes of the chicken and do it from here.
Right.
It's from the back.
Right.
That's interesting.
Right. So part of it is to respect the poor man and his time, that he shouldn't be idled from his work. And you increase the speed, and also to increase the speed, you're starting at the nape, since it's right there. And he won't even have to turn its head to expose the side of the gullet and the windpipe. Then another interesting thought. Okay, so that's like straight up time. The second slightly deeper reason is we are considered a stiff-necked people. And so it's in the neck that we hit that spot, right? In the back. Right, where we're stiff-necked. So something to think about. So we don't want to... So that's just that we're likened to a stiff-necked people, and it should remind us not to be stiff-necked. And then the reason why we don't separate the head completely, because that would be so easy with that one slice. It's a small bird. It's not a chicken. It's a young pigeon.
Pigeon or a dove?
It has to be a baby pigeon or a dove. I think it can't be a full-grown pigeon. So it has to be a small one. So it's a small bird. It could be easily done. You're just talking about a thumbnail. You know, the admonition to not take it off is because you could so easily.
It's so little.
With just the nail. Right, so you have to be careful not to do that. Why? Because it seems that with the head on the offering, it's a more honorable offering.
It probably just looks better.
It's more aesthetic. That's what it says.
It looks more significant.
It says, so the guy is poor. You're going to make him feel even worse by giving a headless offering?
Fit in your hand.
Yeah. So it says, you don't want to make him feel bad that not only is he bringing such a small thing, but it doesn't even have a head on it. Like, at least it should look like something.
Like a bird.
Mm-hmm. So the head should stay on it. So it's interesting just to hear that there's deeper reasons. So I was thinking about it as I was reading through all these offerings, and it's also something to discuss with you. So there's all these offerings that we're learning about. It can get a little tedious. So, a real question for the class is, do we want to skip offerings, you know, or just like kind of run through it faster, or just do it? I feel like we've done enough to kind of get an idea. Or do we want to get more of a concept? I mean, I sort of would like to see, just for my own self, a whole chart of it. You know, who gives what, all the pieces and all that, like, just to see an overview of the whole thing. I don't know. I'll have to look for that. But it's a lot more offerings than I thought there were. Like, a lot of different varieties.
I was talking to somebody about that this week. How far do the offerings go?
I was talking to somebody about...
It's sprinkled throughout.
What's interesting about all of this is we spend, whether it's here or Talmudic or wherever, talking about things that we can't do. Learning.
Right.
Things that, you know, it's interesting, but...
Mm-hmm. Right.
Rich or poor, we can't do this.
And haven't been done for a really long time.
Right.
A really long
time.
So
it's interesting because, there's different things about that. So on the one hand, we can't do it, right? And there is, but there's plenty of material about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but on the other hand, what's the purpose of learning Torah? So the purpose of learning Torah for women is to know what to do and to desire to do it. Both those things. Right? So that's our obligation. Of course, we're allowed to learn past that. The purpose of learning Torah for men is to connect, right? So it's the opposite of Deborah Tannen's stuff. Women talk to connect, men talk to get information. In learning Torah, it's the opposite. Men learn, so they use their language to connect only for that reason, right? I mean, also to learn something out of it, but it's not. If they're not learning anything practical, fine. They can learn about, you know, Korbanot all day long, all month long, all year long, and they're still doing the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Excuse me. And the women learn specifically to get something out of it. So it's the opposite use of language than regular life. That being said, however, we have to understand the concept of why certain things are said. So I wondered, now I'm doing this experiment this year for myself, of reading the Parsha twice in Hebrew and once in translation. Shnayim Mikra v'Echad Targum. That's a concept that men are supposed to do. Read it twice in Hebrew, once in translation. The translation actually being the Aramaic translation of Unklus or somebody like that. Unklus is what's printed right next to it. Because his translation is an interpretive translation. So his translation is in accordance with sagacious understanding, so that certain words or phrases would be translated slightly differently, and people actually do look to Unklus sometimes as a commentary. You know, the way he says it is this, which means that the way the Hebrew word actually, what it really means is that. So there's that concept. For those of us who don't understand Aramaic, we can use the R.E.A. Kaplan translation, because that's also an interpretive translation.
Rabbi Wagner has written books, I think four of them have been published of the five on the Unklus.
Oh, really?
Translating Unklus into English.
Oh, interesting. Oh, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I have one. I'll bring it in.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. Because I was thinking some year I want to get to the Unklus. Look, it would be nice to learn that much Aramaic where that would make sense to you. So hopefully I'll do that. Meanwhile, though,
hello.
Hi. How are you? It's Hakala. Everybody can say Mazel Tov, because Ty is Jewish and officially married.
Officially. Oh, that's
good. Yeah.
Both at the same time.
Oh, once she became Jewish, she had to get married again. So, yeah. Yeah. Very exciting.
It's good to be back.
Yeah. Nice to have you. Yeah. Very exciting.
Where was this?
Last Sunday.
In, up here?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the question that I came up with, I mean, sometimes you don't, you know, there's always a new question when you're learning Chumash. This is such a basic question, but now that I'm reading every pasuk three times, instead of skipping over, quote unquote, boring parts of the Chumash, so now I'm coming up with different questions. So my question for last week, Parshas Tetzaveh, was, why go into so much detail about how you built the Mishkan? And the robes and the vestments, like, really, it seems like that should all be oral law, right? If you think about the structure of the Torah, you know, so we often have a rule, but all the details of the rules are in the Talmud, not details in the written law. Yeah. So it just seemed like there are so many details, you know, which kind of metal and how many frames and how many posts and the metal post should be this and the socket that it goes into should be that. And I was thinking, that's a lot of detail for the Torah. What's with all that? So I asked Rabbi Liban about it. He's never had that question before because I always skip those sections, I hate to say. So he said that if you understand the concept of Torah is the blueprint of the world, right, that God looked into the Torah and from that built the world. So it doesn't mean a blueprint like a real blueprint. It means the spiritual concepts that are there, it's the foundation of the what the world is built on. So if the Beit HaMikdash, or the Ohel, it's all the same, right? The Beit HaMikdash is so important. If that's the source of all Kedusha in the world, and the human being's job is to relate to Kedusha and Tahara in the world, then there must need to be a lot of ink used for concepts of Kedusha and Tahara and how it's built in the world. If that's the foundation. So not, it's not just about how do you build this structure. It's about how do you bring Kedusha into the world. So this is the vehicle through which it's brought. So you have to, in the blueprint of the world, use a lot of space to describe it.
So that's what all of these...
Exactly.
I mean, that's what learning this now.
Right, so that's what learning this is. So learning this is not about how to do a korban at all. And learning it deeper, it's on my list. It's not off my list. It's just a little bit lower on my list because I feel like I have a lot of other things I want to learn. But the truth is, the reason why it's on my list is because if one would learn all about the korbanot, one would understand things in a much deeper way. I don't even know what those things are, but that's what he's alluding to here.
Mm-hmm.
That even if somebody's would their little finger would be as big as our hips, they wouldn't be able to hit that understanding. But there is richness in there. There's deep understandings of how God relates to the world, how we should relate to Him, what is going on here. It's very deep and very mystical and so very interesting to me. That's what I want. So I want to get to that level. You first have to learn all the, what they're all called, who offers them all, why you bring each one, how each one is brought, all that stuff. Like, that's just the top layer. You have to get to that before you can go to a layer below it. And the layer below it, and then get to all the interesting stuff. So that's why we might want to learn it. I feel like we're not learning it that deeply here, and yet we're getting like just the first layer for some later understanding. So why learn it? Why is all that stuff written on it? Because this is how we become close to God. or it has something mm-hmm. about. That's why it's called a korban.
Right.
There's depth
in
here.
Well, today we offer prayer.
Right. But even to understand how to pray, really, you would have to understand the korbanot. Because prayer is instead of korbanot. Korbanot are not instead of prayer.
Right.
Right? So in order to understand actually what you're trying to affect through prayer, you would really need to understand the korbanot and the concepts of korbanot very deeply.
Rabbi Lieben told the story this weekend. He said, so this young man goes to his mentor and said, teach me to pray. And the mentor says, well, it's going to take 10 years. He said, can't take 10 years. Comes back 10 years later. He said, Rabbi, why did you think I could do this in only 10 years?
Right. So it's a big deal. Yeah, I was just talking to one of my Rebbetzins about that. And she's working very hard. She's so cute. I love this one. She's like so full of energy. And she comes up with these epiphanies that are just so adorable. She's Lakewood born and bred. And she's doing Kiruv in an outlying community. And she said, well, I guess I just have to learn how to see the world, like not all black and white. Like I sent her to a therapist because she really needed it. She said, so my therapist is helping me see that there's gray. And she's 30-ish, right? I'm like, right, that's great. There's gray. Yes.
You're either on our side or you're not on our side.
There's gray in this world. I said, it's a hard place to live in gray. But she said, because what I was taught was all black and white. She said, high school and seminary, and like, it's just black and white, black and white, black and white. And now I'm seeing that there's gray. And then I have to tolerate, like, different ways of people doing things. I'm like,
yes.
Right.
But you know what? That's huge.
It's huge. It's huge.
I mean, I think that's, you know, that is a huge, you know, we are facing and dealing with that all across the gamut in our lives these days.
Yep.
I mean, it's
getting
like the political issues.
White.
Exactly.
You know, all that stuff. Everybody sees
extremism.
Everything as, you know, my way is the right way or the white or whichever it did, and mm-hmm. the other way is the wrong way, and there's no mm-hmm. no compromise, nothing in between, nothing,
right.
nothing.
No
it's
spectrum.
Either the right way or it's
or
not
you're
the
out
right
of my
way.
Life. Right. Or you're out of my life.
You know, so for someone.
Right, so it's
you
huge
know,
for her to see that.
Especially in
doing
that
Kira.
Job.
Mm-hmm.
In that job, you've got to
right.
be able to tolerate
right.
gray, or you could make yourself insane.
Right, right. And she was going
well,
a little bit insane.
Well, can't do job.
Literally and figuratively.
I mean, she was like just living in a more like hippie-ish environment, and it was just so hard for her. Like, she just didn't understand people. Like, how do they? Why do they care about this? Or like, why is recycling important? Or why? Like, she just didn't get it. Like. Why do people like expend energy on that and not on what's important?
And not on what? Right, there's nothing in the Torah about recycling.
So, like, she's learning.
Probably is.
There's different ways. Yeah, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is. But she just didn't ever learn that. So she's just learning that there's different ways and to not judge, and people can have, there can be parallel, correct ways. And it is huge. So I said, you know, it probably takes 10 years to learn. I said, it's great you're starting that. It probably takes 10 years to learn that. I said, I keep learning that. It's just ever unfolding. In your life. She said, well, isn't that the way it is with every midah? And I was like, yeah, I guess that is. That is the way it is with everything that you're working on, is that it's ever unfolding. You get the concept, and then you get it again deeper, and you get it again deeper, and you get it again deeper, right? That you don't have to judge, that there are different ways. I mean, I'm so different than I was, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, for sure, mm-hmm. in terms of expansiveness, and not just tolerance, that whatever, you could do what you want, but like a holding a preciousness of, yes, you can choose your own path and it's important. You know, it's like, it's a different concept of just whatever. So anyway, constantly unfolding.
Well,
so that's what it is, I hope, with learning Torah
it
also.
It seems to me that there is benefit in, you know, studying all these korbanot. And, you know, maybe as compared to some of the other things, we don't need to do them in as much depth. You know,
fly
based upon
mm-hmm.
your, you know, evaluation of the messages and importance that we could get from them. But it seems to me if we're going through something,
you should
then
just
need go to through
okay.
it.
Okay,
that's
just
my
checking.
Opinion.
Because
anyway.
I just wanted to hear, because I was feeling like maybe there was some, like we want
Friends
something a little more practical.
629 of 613.
Okay, let's keep going.
$125.
We're gonna get to 129.
All right.
Okay, good. So 124. So don't cut off the head right. while you're doing this. So now we know what Malika is. So Malika is the kind of killing of a bird that you do that it could be a, it doesn't have to be just be a Kohen. So I was wondering if it's just the Kohen, but you can tell from the end, right, this mitzvah is in effect in the temple is extant for Kohanim and every man, meaning anybody can do this. It's not just the Kohen.
So other people participated in...
Yeah, there are different people who could bring certain korbanot. Again, this is where I'd like to see the chart.
Certain
korbanot can only be okay. slaughtered by a Kohen, and certain other ones can be killed by anybody.
As long as
everything is done the right way. It still has to be offered by a Kohen. But the killing, which is part of the preparation for the offering, could be done by anyone.
I see.
So Malika is the type of killing that's done with a thumbnail from the back of the neck on a small bird. And the head can't be severed. That's this mitzvah. Don't sever. When you're killing the bird that way for an offering, don't sever the head. That's the mitzvah 124. Not to separate the head of a bird brought as a chatat. Hello. Were you also stuck in that awful traffic?
Horrible.
I'm so glad I didn't leave when you left.
It took 2 minutes to get here.
Yeah,
oh my
bad,
gosh.
Wasn't it?
It's bumper to bumper. At Hamden, it loosens up.
Right.
So what happens at Hamden? They gave a ride or something?
They were cleaning up the highway, because I got caught in it too, but I was obviously ahead of you. They were cleaning up the highway. Somebody had dropped a bunch of I don't know what, and they had the right two lanes blocked off, and people were actually on the highway picking the stuff up, so they had the truck sort of protecting the people who were physically picking the stuff up, but it resulted in a huge traffic jam. It was pretty bad.
Why they had to do that now. Okay.
It didn't look like the stuff was dangerous.
No, it didn't look like for mica tops or something like that, for counters. Or
maybe.
So it like thin. Broken up in pieces. Yeah, that's what it looked like. So you could drive right over it.
But probably
get a
tire,
or probably swerve around, or you know, I mean, I think maybe that's, I don't know.
They need a sign on the sideway to tell you what's going on.
Yeah, if they had one of those things that said slow traffic ahead for the next 10 miles.
Get off now.
It wouldn't have to be one of those temporary things, it could be permanent.
Right. Okay,
moving on.
That's Mitzvah 124. Up to 125. Okay. 125 and 120. What did I do here? I forgot to change the 125 to 126. Yeah, 125 and 126. Not to put olive oil in an unintentional sinner's meal offering. And 126, to put no frankincense in an unintentional sinner's meal offering.
That could be an all-time record short one.
But 126, yes. 126. That's why we're going to look at them together. Because they're really the same, except for just a different, you just substitute that word, which is why I cut and pasted and then, forgot to change the number. right. So, unintentional sinner's meal offering, right? So, this is a mincha offering. And who offers a mincha? This is a flour offering, right? So, it's only can be offered by a, I love the vocabulary we're getting here in English, penurious sinner.
Mm-hmm. That means unintentionally?
No.
Penurious.
Poor.
Poor.
Penury is poverty. Oh. Right. So it can only be offered by a poor sinner because it's a meal offering, right? So that's the even lower than a bird. Somebody who's that poor that they can't even bring a bird, they just bring a bit of flour. Because they said,
we talked about that last
right? Because so it's understood that as poor as you are, nobody would be without even a bit of flour. Which I'm sure in some places in the world that's the case. Hopefully in Israel it was the case. In Eretz Israel it was the case that nobody was ever that poor that they didn't have a bit of flour. So you could still bring a meal offering, a mincha. But once you're bringing that mincha, so should you be adding oil to it or frankincense to it, to things that elevate that offering? So the answer is no. If you're bringing the offering that's of somebody that's poor, so no, you don't add expensive oil or expensive frankincense to it. Those are too pricey to add to this offering. So A, you don't want to burden the poor person with having to either go
buy
the money of it or by the time of it, just like we just learned, in the other offering of why we do Malika altogether is to save the time of the poor person who needs to be working. So you also don't want to ask him to go out and find oil for his offering. It's enough, you should just bring a bit of flour. So it's interesting because there's a concept that God makes it easy for us to gain atonement. So, and he says specifically in the offering, so there's, and I didn't count, but it says, I think there's 10 kosher animals, and I only ask for 3 of them. And so it must be categories, 10 kosher categories and 3 categories he asks for. But he says, there's never an offering of a heart a deer, something that you have to go catch, a buck, whatever, an elk, you know, or a moose. You don't have to go capture one of those to bring to the Beit HaMikdash. It's too hard, right? He said, I only ask for that which is in your manger, something that you have access to. So you don't have to go find a difficult kosher animal to offer. I want to make it easy for you. So that which is in your backyard, offer that. So
domesticated.
Right, in your backyard or somebody else's backyard. They had a whole market, of course, for korbanot. I think I tell you, I just finished reading the book of my friend who writes about the Third Temple established very, very soon. So it's in today, basically. And talks about the Mikdash websites and the and the high-speed train that's going to be in Yerushalayim and the area where the korbanot will be held and the train system to bring in the animals and the train system for all the guests and the different mikvahs to help with people, and then the Mikdash Institute, which is established for training people and then for training Gentiles in how to keep Torah law, because they'll want that once the Beit HaMikdash is restored. You know, there'll be lots of Gentiles who want to understand how they should be a Gentile, because the gates for conversion will be closed. Whew, you made it. No more conversion once Mashiach comes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So, but
if you want to get in, get in now. Yeah, that's right.
Really?
Yeah. I learned that from Yaffa Shurtleff. I didn't even know that. Yeah, because I remember talking to Yaffa Shurtleff before when she was Jewish, and she was like frustrated that it was taking so long. She's like, I just like, she said, I know Mashiach is coming soon, and I just want to make sure that I get in before he gets here.
The reason or the logic behind that
won't need it.
I think, but I'm not positive, that the reason is that you can't convert because we're the winning team.
So it's like you can't join when it's already obvious we're winning. It's like you can't get on board after the train has left the station.
You can't bet at halftime.
Right.
Can't bet at halftime.
And that's a deeper concept too, because if you think about it, part of being Jewish, we have a lot to teach the world, but part of how we teach the world is through our bodies, through the suffering that we've endured, and that's something that we took on at Purim, was that we were willing to be physical examples to the world. So to attach ourselves, it's a deeper concept that I don't fully grasp and certainly can't fully explain, but it is part of being Jewish. Part of being a light unto the nations is that we still exist today. It's a total miracle. Mm-hmm. Anybody who actually looks at us can see it's a complete and total miracle that we actually physically exist today. So we like to say, oh, whatever, you know, they were smart, it worked out, and this, that. But the truth is, if you really learn history, world history, there's no way we should be here. No way. So there is part of carrying miracles in our flesh forward that is an aspect of being Jewish. So that's going to change with the Mashiach coming. We won't need that aspect anymore, and we will become that priestly nation, a holy nation, of kingdom of priests, right? People who are all clergy teaching the world. But it's because we earned it. It's because we got there. It's because we made those transitions, and the transitions are hard. It's hard to convert now. You know, even now, even in this country, even where it's pretty comfortable, even where Jews are safe, basically, and even where there's enough money, and we all eat, and we have to worry about Shabbos and all that stuff, it's still really hard. It is hard to make the transition, to break away from family, to be different, to be an other within the Jews. You want to carry the message, and you're still, it's hard to get in, it's hard to stay in. So there is something that the convert earns too, through that journey, that you won't be available. It's just, that's not something you can access.
We convert every day.
Right, we do. We all Gary Hetzedek, right? I told my husband, I said, you know, I mentioned specifically,
personally,
in the prayers on a daily basis. He said, me too. There's a whole prayer named after me. I said, there is? He said, yeah, Aleinu. Because in that bracha, it says, you know, bless the this, the that, the Gerei Tzedek, and us, Aleinu. Send bracha to the Gerei Tzedek and Aleinu.
Right.
So then the rest of us, right? Aleinu. So he said, there's a whole prayer named after me. It's the Aleinu.
Ephraim, Aleinu. My father used to say, it never said stop, Harry, on the stop sign.
Right. That's what my kids told me, is that if the stop sign has a white border, it's optional.
Okay, then.
It's good to learn from teenagers. Okay, so anyway, when you're bringing that offering of poverty, the offering, the lowest level offering financially, so to that you did not add in olive oil or frankincense, two things that elevate it. So we all know the price of oil, he says, and good oil is worthwhile, and that's why we use it for things like anointing people. So we don't add it to this. Excuse me, and we also don't add frankincense. So, and he says, it's so interesting, he says, there's the theme of frankincense is wholly like the theme about the oil, which of which we've written. There's no need to continue about it. That's why 126 is so short. So the two are basically the same. Just substitute the word. So we just don't add something extra rich to something that's poor.
I think that the important thing that you just said, or somebody said, is that God makes tshuva easy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it's not supposed to be...
Right.
You know, a lifetime of...
It's supposed to be accessible. It's supposed to be very accessible.
Accessible. Yeah.
Accessible.
So on the
yeah.
one hand, it's not easy. Right, it's not.
Yeah, I don't think
accessible maybe is a better word.
It's supposed to be... It's not supposed to be something that's too hard for you to do. The whole Torah is supposed to be not something that's too hard for you to do. So it is... It's interesting because I hear people say, oh, it's so expensive to be an Orthodox Jew. You know, you have all these kashrus and you know, sukkah and lulav and esrog and matzah and all these expenses, you know, and day school tuition is so expensive. And how can you afford everything? And I think, you know what? What's expensive is to be a person who lives in the 21st century of America. We have all these standards that are expensive, like green grass, right? Mm-hmm. It costs a lot of money to have green grass. You have to install a whole sprinkler system and pay a ton of money to sprinkle it and have people come and mow it and edge it, or you're spending that time mowing and edging it, which means in order to have just green grass, you know, so maybe you can't afford day school tuition and green grass. So then the question is, which one is more important? Oh, I'm serious. There's all kinds of things. The cars that we drive and the clothes that we wear and the size house that we have and the warmth or the coolness of, you know, the environment of our home. All right. These things. You know, the size of the home that we have, the amount of food that we have. There's so much that we just take for granted as standard of living. But the truth is, that costs a ton of money. A ton. And if we will look at our priorities, we might decide slightly different than, you know, maybe it's expensive to live like an American, but being a Jew is reasonable. So, anyway. So it is accessible.
Well,
we just have to decide.
We'll still question why kosher meat is so expensive, but not here.
Right. No, that's a problem, but yeah. Okay. 127. To add a fifth of the value in paying for hallowed food that was eaten. Okay, so somebody either inadvertently or on purpose derives benefit from something sacred that he shouldn't have. So this is inadvertently. If he eats holy food inadvertently. So truma. Somebody set aside the truma, right? Yeah, I just, you know, I harvested my apples. I set aside the truma. It's in a pile. It's a big pile because I had a nice apple crop, right? So now my kid comes home from yeshiva, and he sees the big pile of apples, and he's thinking, that must be the pile you can eat from because look how big it is, right? And doesn't realize that's actually the truma that's set aside. So he has apples. He makes applesauce, whatever, right? He uses a bunch. Oh, now he inadvertently ate from something holy. Should not have had that. So he ate 10 apples. He has to pay back the 10 apples plus a fifth. Now, it turns out the calculation of plus a fifth actually is a fourth. So that it's a fifth of the whole.
Oh.
Right.
It's a fourth more.
It's a fourth more, which makes it a
fifth
altogether.
Whole.
Right. So you eat 10 apples, you have to give back 2.5 apples. So it's 12 and a half. So that the 2.5 is actually a fifth of the entire amount. So adding fifth to it. And then you have to bring an offering, I think, right?
Yeah.
That's us, mm-hmm, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right? I just want to make sure. Yeah, you bring the Asham. Right, right,
add
right.
A fifth of it.
So this is just the adding the fifth. But then you also have to bring the offering, right? So the concept is to keep holy things holy. And so here's another question that I have brewing. Just because I do have the blessing of that child who constantly is testing me and asking me hard things. So he likes to, yeah. So he likes to constantly point out that we have violence in our text. Kill this person, kill that person, kill, 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 death, death, death. Death for the, like, you know, littlest thing or whatever it is, not even the littlest thing, like, you know, She was betrothed and she had sex with somebody else. Kill her by stoning. That's what it says. Right? So I first had to explain to him that betrothed doesn't mean like our kind of engagement is actually a contract. You actually sign it. That's why we don't do it until the wedding today. That it is, you're actually,
really you're committed,
you need a get from that. Like if you actually officially betrothed, you need a get to get out of that betrothal. That's not just, will you marry me? Yes, I will. And now if you sleep with somebody else, stone. And stoning is not stoning either. I mean, the way it works, yeah. So
what is it then?
So you kill,
good question.
You kill somebody with a big rock and then throw little rocks. But it's not.
So in other words, they're killed pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You're still killed. You're still dead.
Still killed. But then the question is, okay, so how does that happen? You only get the death penalty if two witnesses see you about to do the act, warn you of the act, and the correct punishment. So you would have to know all the right punishments.
And you do it anyway.
You can't say, if you sleep with this guy, you're going to get the death penalty. You have to say, if you sleep with this guy, you're going to get death by stoning. And if you say death by sword, that's not a proper warning. So you have to tell the person, you have to see the person before, two people, to see the person before they're about to do it. Warn them what the sin is and what the punishment is. The person has to acknowledge that and then do the sin in front of witnesses. And then the witnesses are obligated to go tell the Beit Din, and then the Beit Din can hand down the punishment. Okay, so
it didn't happen to me.
No, so it's considered
probably not for that one.
Right, probably not. It's but it is considered that if the Beit Din hands down the death penalty once in 70 years, it's considered a bloody Beit Din. So it did not happen often. Okay, so now what's up with saying it so often? Why does it say it so often? Why is it all over the place? Death, right? So is it warning? Is it deterrent? I think it's also about categorizing. You know, it's letting us know the severity of the sin, right? This is a sin where the result of it is death.
Could be.
Right? Not just that you're going to get killed. That's not the concept. The concept is, what is the spiritual consequence of this? Because even if you'd, so without the witnesses, and without the warning, and without the Beit Din, you still committed something that the result is death. Right? So now God's in charge of that death. God saw it. God knows. And God will hand it down. So there are certain things for which only death atones. Now we get to have like concurrent atonement with the one death that we get. You know, the story about they go down to the Lower East Side, they interviewed an elderly gentleman there, and they said, you know, sir, Mr. Klein, you know, could you please tell us about what you feel the death rate is here in the Lower East Side? He said, well, according to my opinion, I think that the death rate here on the Lower East Side is about one to a person. So it is only one to a person, even if you did a lot of things that incur the death penalty. So you get that concurrent atonement with the one death, if you did tshuva. If you didn't do tshuva, so there's what to pay on the other side, for sure. So part of saying, you know, is the categorizing of the severity of the transgression. If we understand that mitzvot are about making a connection with God, and averot are about destroying that connection with God. So then you want to know, how much does it destroy? How much does it connect? Right? So it says in Pirkei Avos, so we're supposed to not really categorize that way. We're supposed to be just as careful with an easy mitzvah as with a hard mitzvah. Or you could retranslate those words, with a light mitzvah as with a hard mitzvah, meaning the punishment is light. So we should be just as careful with something for which the punishment is lashes, and the punishment is death. Right? We should be just as careful with those two mitzvahs. But the concept is you do want to understand what really matters. And so assigning a punishment to something does say what really matters. So I think that's why it says it so often. Still have to get to how to explain to somebody who's
16.
No.
Why does it say it? Because the text has to be, there has to be a reason for the text saying it that way too. Why doesn't it just say, this is an important one, this is an important one, this is an important one? There could be a different way to phrase it. Why was that way chosen to phrase it? So I don't know all the answers
yet. Time and space.
Yeah, so if God can do whatever God wants, which God can, so you have to ask why God chose that.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, although he rails against it, I mean, all these kids, it's not just Donnie, you know, they rail against it, but, you know, they pour through it enough to know what's there. You know,
right, that's, and it's interesting to see. So, so we'll see how he grows and I grow through this whole episode of growth-producing questions.
My nephew did that. He's about to go to yeshiva, so.
Good. Good. You should go learn and grow and be a light unto the nation. Okay, so anyway, the concept is if one inadvertently consumes or has benefit from something that is holy, meaning something that is set aside for a purpose other than him, so this is not just stealing, so it's not just other than him, but something set aside for temple use or Kohanic use or something like that that has kedusha. Kedusha here really meaning set aside, sanctified for the specific use of temple purpose. Then he has to add on a fifth. How much? What's the smallest amount that he had to use that this falls on? So one pruta. So that's a penny's worth, basically. So even if, by mistake, he took a penny out of the tzedakah box and used that for something, I don't know, let's say he needed to turn a screw. Couldn't find a screwdriver. Takes a penny out of the tzedakah box so he can turn that screw and then totally forgets to put it back in the tzedakah box, puts it in his pocket, and goes and spends it on a penny candy, right? So then he is chayev to add a fifth onto that and to bring in the offering. He used something he shouldn't have used that was consecrated for something else. And then it goes on, it just adds a little bit, like how far can that go, right? Let's say he gives that penny to a poor person. Right? Does that poor person who spends that penny now also have to bring an offering? So the answer is no. Once it's been made not holy or used for not holy, there's only one layer of it. It doesn't continue to the next person and to the next person, because imagine that would be ridiculous. You know, none of us would know how far it goes, or, you know, the origin of the money that we're using or the stuff that we're eating. We wouldn't be able to, it would be too much research required. So it's just one layer. That person has to bring the offering. The next person, it doesn't fall on them at all. Okay. 128, the precept of an asham talui, an offering for doubtful guilt. So this is interesting. This is talui. It doesn't really mean doubtful. It means hanging. Talui. It's hanging. So we don't quite know. So it is doubtful. So, but this is doubtful where you did something for sure, and it could have been usser, but you don't know if it was usser. So, for instance, the example he gives, there's two pieces of fat in front of you. One is kosher, and one is not. And you ate one, but you don't know which was which. So you for sure ate one. You did something. You for sure ate it, but you don't know which is which, and the second one got lost. So you can't even test to see that was for sure the one that wasn't kosher. So you ate the one that's kosher. So now you did something that might have been usser, but you don't know if it was usser. So in order to atone from that, you bring this offering. So that's why it's called talui, because you might come to find out. Like maybe the person who put those two pieces of fat is going to come in the room and say, oh yeah, the one on the left is kosher, the one on the right was treif. And now you know which one you ate. So now the doubt's resolved. But meanwhile, you're in doubt. Right? Maybe that person was away on a sea voyage and they came back in a year and resolved it. If it's resolved that what you did was the wrong thing for sure, then you have to bring a chatat. You have to bring another korban. If it's resolved that what you did wasn't a problem, so then you don't have to worry about it. What you did atone, because you did do something that you don't know for sure, so you actually do need atonement for that, because you weren't even sure and you did something that you weren't sure about. So that needs atonement. There is really a lack of care there. But the Asham Talui takes care of that. And but once you find out that it's actually Esther, you have to bring the Korban Chatat.
So then you have to bring two.
Yeah.
And if you find out.
If you find out for sure.
Because the first one really is only in the case of when you don't know.
It's a conditional offer.
Sure. Right.
Right. Okay. And if you never find out for sure,
then you're okay.
Then it covers you.
Right.
If you do find out for sure, you have to bring the Chatat. Right. So that's what a korban talui is. And now, and we are going to finish today, I'm so excited. The precept of asham vadai. Vadai means for sure. One thing I'm really enjoying, especially in my Shnai Mikra V'Echad Targum, and also in reading this kind of thing, is seeing the origins of modern Hebrew in the language. There's so many bits and pieces, of course, because modern Hebrew was figured out from all this Hebrew. But it's just fun to see it there, and thinking about Eliezer ben Yehuda and the work that he did to make this language alive, you know, and he gave his life for it and his kids' lives, basically, because he made them pariahs in their community because they, you know, they lived in a Yiddish-speaking world. They lived in a Yiddish-speaking world, and they were the people around him were totally opposed to speaking Hebrew and ostracized him and his children, and it was terrible. But it is amazing to see the work that he did in mining words and finding them and making them into usable modern Hebrew. It's fascinating. Anyway, so vadai. So we use that word. Vadai means for sure. And the precept of an asham vadai, an offering for definite guilt. So this is different than a chatat. And this is for five specific sins. This is a long mitzvah.
Really long.
Yeah. It's a long mitzvah because it deals with one extra piece. But let's first look at the five specific sins. If I can find that paragraph, and then we'll deal with this extra part when we get to that. Okay, the five specific sins that this takes care of, this is on page 61, that the Mishnah enumerates, are the Asham Gezelot, a guilt offering for robberies. Asham Me'ilot, a guilt offering for breaches of holiness. The Asham Shivcha Harufa, the guilt offering for the bespoken maidservant, which we'll talk about in a minute, the Asham of the Nazarite, and the Asham of the Metzora. So as for Asham Talui, which is listed there, that's about the Metzora, its name attests that it's not the same kind of Asham Vadai, so that's a whole different long thing. There's these five Ashams. These are the five Asham Vadais. So the first one is, if one steals, the law is the same. So now, this is not the eight kachim by mistake. They stole something, right? They see a $20 bill on the table. They take it because they need it, whatever, for whatever they want it. But now they do tshuva. So now they have to return $25 to the person they stole it from and bring a korban. Why? So we have the rule of returning the fifth, but we don't. But the reason why we have the korban is to drive home the point that this is nevera. Don't think you can just take an unauthorized loan. Don't see that $20 bill and say, you know, I really need the $20. And next week I have a job. I'll be able to repay the $25. You're not allowed to take a loan at interest, right? But in a way, you might think to yourself, it's not that much. I need the $20 now. I'll return the $25 later.
Out of the cash drawer.
Right. And I can do that, right? Take it out of the cash drawer, right? Nobody's even going to know, right? And I'll just return the $25. Right, so no, it's a sin. You have to bring a korban for it afterwards. So you have to return the fifth and bring a korban. So this is the korban vadai. That's the asham gezelot. The next one is me'ilot. That's where you purposely eat purposely eat holy things. That we discussed. The other one was about when you make a mistake in that. The guilt offering for the bespoken maidservant, which we'll talk about in a second. The Asham of the Nazarite, number four, that's when a Nazarite becomes Tamei. A Nazarite's not allowed to become Tamei. So if they, by mistake, become Tamei, then they have to bring an Asham. And the Asham of the Metzora, so that's for somebody who has leprosy, which is, of course, because of a spiritual imperfection that's their fault. So once they're healed from the leprosy, they have to bring a guilt offering because they did something that caused the leprosy. So now let's look at the number three, the guilt offering for the bespoken maidservant. So he goes into this here because there's not another place to discuss it, he says. Even though this is not in our parsha, this is where he has to discuss it because it is listed in this asham and nowhere else, really, in the Torah that makes it an easy place to discuss it. So he talks about it here.
Where so, are you again?
It's in this, let's see.
61.
Right, 63. So now 63. So okay. So this is for somebody who is a maidservant, meaning, excuse me, it's a specific halachic place where she's half free, excuse me, and half slave. So, for instance, she was sold into slavery, and she already earned enough money to buy half of herself back, right? And now she's betrothed. And somebody else, not the one she's betrothed to, somebody else sleeps with her. So now the question is, was something stolen, not stolen? To whom does she belong? Is it her? Is it somebody else? Can he just steal that virginity, or just even the time with her, even if she's not a virgin? How does he atone for that? What's the story with that? It's a whole long thing. Who is she and how is it? And so in order to give her more weight, it's an aveira. It's a solid aveira for which you have to bring a korban, because it might be that a maidservant will be taken lightly, that people will just think they can have their way with her.
So he has to bring a korban,
not she. She, if she doesn't protest, gets lashed. But she doesn't bring that korban. So she does have to protest. And there's different things about rape in the Torah. What is rape? Date rape, consensual. So we don't talk about, certainly in our paradigm, consensual rape. But seduction, I think that would be seduction. She didn't really mean it. She didn't really go for it. But she didn't stop it. So if it was violent, she's not held accountable for stopping it. But if she's seduced, she is held accountable for allowing herself to be seduced. She has to have more strength than that. So a girl who's raped in the city and doesn't cry out, she's punished. A girl who's raped in the field, whether or not she cries out, is not punished, because nobody could have come to her aid. But in the city, it's considered somebody could have. She should cry out. Then she's off the hook.
Dina was in the field, right?
Mm-hmm. Pardon?
Dina was in the field.
Right. No.
Wasn't she?
Dina was, I think she was in the city. She wasn't engaged, though. This is for an engaged girl. Because it's adulterous once you're engaged. Right. Right. So it's interesting. Dina, right. The brothers took care of it. And why? I just learned something also. Why was that okay with the surrounding tribes? Why weren't they attacked roundly for killing that whole city, which was wrong, and they shouldn't have? But there is no repercussion from surrounding cities. Because everybody agrees that the rape of a minor, the rape of a child, is not okay. There's no culture in which that's okay. So they took revenge, maybe too strong, but it was understandable in everybody's eyes. You don't rape a child. And she was a child. Mm-hmm. And that says she went out to go see the other girls. Mm-hmm. That she didn't have interest in boys yet. She wasn't going to see the sight. She was going to see the girls. She wanted to go play, right? And she was raped. So that revenge that was taken, strong though it was understandable in the context that you don't rape children. In this case, this maidservant who is already engaged to somebody but isn't yet married, and she's also not fully free, so which also means she's not fully Jewish yet, because I think you have to be free first. There's all kinds of laws in this, and I don't know all the laws. But anyway, to give her the benefit, he has to offer a korban if he violates her, so that she has more weight in his eyes. It's not just a girl he could do what he wants with, but she is a human being for which it's a sin to seduce or rape, and he has to bring that korban. Probably rape is even different. I think this is seduction. But again, there's so much to learn. This is just the headlines.
What's interesting is that had she been a free woman, then the sentence is death.
Yes.
It says right here that for a maidservant, even if she is half redeemed, is lightly regarded.
Right. Right. Right.
She just wasn't quite.
And she doesn't have the weight of full status.
So she gets some protection.
The korban affords her more protection.
Yeah. More than
that she is held in the light.
More than a servant.
It's not saying that the Torah holds her in that light esteem. It's that people do.
Right.
And so the Torah is shoring her up.
Right.
By requiring the korban to atone for that. Right? Isn't that how you understand the text? Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's that it's a social thing that she's not held with esteem.
Yeah,
not that the Torah doesn't.
No, it talks about people.
It's people.
Right.
So in order to protect her, there's a special korban just for violating her, to give her extra stature to protect her. Right, but if she was totally free and engaged, right, then the man who would do that to her would get the death penalty.
And had she been a slave,
she does get
if she doesn't cry out, if she agrees, if she does it willingly.
If she'd been a total slave, not half free, then she would have no protection.
Yeah, so I don't know all that. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It would still be ulcer, just the question is, what's the punishment?
What's the punishment, right?
So it's not just the question, what's the punishment? That's why there's different punishments. So that is the question, but the question is how the punishments delineate the severity of the crime. Mm-hmm. So I don't know all the answers here, you know, and I don't know why all the different levels and what all that means, and there's tons to learn there. But that is, in this Asham Vadai, that is one of the categories, one of the five categories of the Asham Vadais, is the Asham Vadai for the Shifcha Harufa. That's what it's called. The bespoken maidservant, Shifcha Harufa. Right. And that's it today. So there's no inspiring piece to end on. Except
not
that,
so much.
I know, I should have thought of something inspiring. What do we have inspiring in all of this? I guess we should look back to 124 for inspiring, about the care that we should take, even with somebody poor, to not use up their time when they don't have the extra time to spare, and to make their offering respectable by
right.
not severing the head, that we have to give somebody, even somebody who's very poor, that extra kavod, reach out to them and make sure that they feel okay and their time is respected. So I think that's something that we could easily
think,
right?
Definitely. I think definitely.
Yeah. That, to even respect
definitely.
The... Because it's easy when we earn a lot per hour to not respect the time of somebody who earns a very little per hour, saying that our time
is all
worth
the time.
More.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
All the time.
And the truth is, I have two different cleaning ladies, and I have one who's pretty poor. And she... Usually I just pay at the end of the week. I pay her each time, because that's what she wants, each time. But she needs the money that day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It makes a difference to her.
That's what you're supposed to do, yeah. is pay every day.
Right, right. You can agree. You can make an agreement to pay mm-hmm. at the end. So, like, for one of the cleaning ladies I have, I can pay her at the end of the week. And if I'm traveling, I can pay her at the end of the second week. She doesn't need the money. She needs the money.
But
she doesn't need it that
instantly.
Day. But the other one needs it that day. When she works, she needs the money. So, yeah, it's even though it's not that much per hour, that she needs
it's
that money.
A lot for her.
Yeah,
it's all she has.
Right. So we should be protective of their time.
Favorite, then.